I'm on thousands a week, cars, clubs, you name it, you can have it. You're in a dangerous position, I'd say, with your mental health.
How many hamstring injuries did you have?
I probably ended up having around 10 now. To be honest, I'm proud of coming out on the other side of it. There's not many good guys in football. So when you get them, keep them around you.
Hello everyone, welcome to More Than a Name, the podcast that explores the untold, unfiltered stories of sports figures. Max Whittle and Luke Young with you as always. Before we introduce our guest today, I did just want to say a big thank you to everyone who has supported the podcast so far. Please do subscribe to our YouTube channel, More Than a Name Podcast, and if you can, leave us just a nice review, not a bad review, a nice review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really does go a long way. Last but not least, we are at More Than a Name Pod on Instagram and TikTok, so follow along as we continue to grow. Today's guest has lived the kind of football journey most of us don't see behind the headlines. Charlie Wakefield was a kid with a dream, picked up by Chelsea at just 12, training alongside future stars, chasing that Premier League moment. But injuries hit hard and Charlie has had to recover and adapt many times. What's powerful though is how he's kept going, rebuilding, finding new purpose through spells at Coventry, Wealdstone, Bromley, Yeovil, Woking, Braintree Town, and learning who he is beyond the setbacks and beyond the sport. Charlie now runs his own business, 1% Supplements. It's a story about resilience, identity, and what it really means to love the game. Charlie Wakefield, welcome to More Than a Name. How are you?
That's a great intro. Appreciate that. Really pleased to be on.
We've been talking a lot this morning about all sorts. So I guess, Luke, I'm just going to throw it over to you first of all. Where would you like to start with Charlie and his incredible story?
Yeah, I think the best place to start is when you are playing football as a youngster. What did that look like?
Yeah, so started local team was a team called Fishersgate Flyers, which, yeah, you won't know that.
Good name.
Exactly. I ended up getting a trial at Brighton, but they weren't nothing like they are today. So they were playing in, they were probably a struggling League One side, but obviously still being a Brighton boy, it was a great opportunity to get scouted by them. Managed to do enough to get in, which was great. Went from Fishersgate to Brighton, where I spent a couple of seasons and then was fortunate enough to actually get a trial at Chelsea. I was actually a Chelsea fan growing up, so boyhood dream to get that opportunity. So I actually got scouted for Chelsea in a school game, which people probably wouldn't think because they see the transition from Brighton to Chelsea and think I was probably playing for Brighton, but I was actually playing for my school with my friends, which at that time a lot of players that were in academies didn't do because they didn't want you playing for your school, you might get injured. But I just love playing with my friends, and I would say to like my dad, oh, I really want to play in the school game still. And the opposition's manager was a Chelsea scout, like, so he'd done part-time scouting for Chelsea, and then he was a PE teacher. We lost the game. I remember it really well. We lost 2-1, but I must have done okay in the game because after the match, he sort of got directed to my dad, and he just gave my dad his card and said, look, I'm a Chelsea scout. We want to have your son up on a trial. And my dad sort of turned to me and said, oh, look, he was a Chelsea scout. You've got a trial. So obviously I've gone from being a bit down in the dumpster. Wow, like this is massive. Like this couldn't have been any better in terms of the opportunity I wanted being a fan, like I was saying. So that's how the journey became what it was to get into Chelsea's academy.
You're still just 27. How quickly have you had to grow up?
I've had to be really independent from a young age. So at 14, I actually left home to go and move into Diggs, which for people that don't know, it's basically you go and live with a family, or for example, I just lived with a woman and a dog. So from 14, I've been very independent, you know, left home, left from Brighton to move up to Cobham near Chelsea training ground. So growing up's, I suppose, different to say a typical 14-year-old up till 27.
You signed with Chelsea at 12. What didn't you know about academy football then that you would like to educate people now about?
For me, so when I was at Brighton, I, without sounding like big-headed or because that's definitely not what I want to sound like, but I sort of was at that stage where I'd established myself in my team, was really enjoying the football I was playing, and could probably say I was one of the, not better players, but more established players in the team. And then you go from that to Chelsea, where you are sort of surround yourself now with boys from London, voiced out of experience things that you've not experienced, the confidence they had compared to me. I was just a shy boy from Brighton, walking into a change room. Even at 12 years old, I remember my dad taking me up to Cobham for the first time, and you sort of get there, and then on the door it says players and staff only. And then he was like, "Oh, are you ready now then?" Like, and I was like, yep, ready. And you sort of have to go down, and you walk down this long corridor on your own, and you see your door that you're meant to go into, and you sort of open it, and then you've got all these lads in there. And then you just got to get to grips with it as fast as you can, really, because you're on trial, there's no time to waste, and you've got to make your opportunity work.
We'll focus on Chelsea a fair amount here. Luke, you've got some thoughts on how they view their assets, I would say.
Whether it's right or it's wrong, I know that part of the way that Chelsea do it in the academy is that they will scour the country for the best boys at lesser teams or Cat 2 or Cat 1 sides, and they'll pay fees for the best players that will come into the building, and you're then surrounded by basically the best players in the country and sometimes in Europe as well, that some of the boys come over. They then get given like big contracts at the age of 17, so as soon as they're able to sign a pro contract. But the money to me seems like astronomical compared to what it could be. It doesn't seem like it needs to be 10 grand a week, 15 grand a week for one of the best prospects in the country.
It's funny, isn't it? Because like you're saying, you've not played a first team game. So especially in my case, I think, you know, you go on loan to a first team football club and they're probably looking at you already with the opinion of, God, he's turning up in a fancy car, isn't he? And he's not actually played a minute of first team football yet. So it's tough. It's tough because you're not going to turn down the money that you get offered at that age because you didn't ask for it. They're just putting it on the table potentially. Of course, players and agents and parents might negotiate, but the initial figure is always going to be high at Chelsea because, like you're saying, that's just what they were willing to give and offer players. But it is a tricky one because, like I said, I remember my first loan was to Stevenage when I was 18, and I remember rocking up in my car, and I think I pulled into the training ground and I was just behind the manager, and I probably had a better car than him without sounding arrogant, and it probably didn't leave a good impression, you know, because he's thinking, well, we've got this lad on loan. He actually didn't take me on loan. It was the manager before that ended up getting the sack, but they still allowed me to go there. And I just think, yeah, at that age, personally, if you've not played a first team game, then already you're going to get the look of almost disrespect from senior players because you've not played a game. Just going back to it, you're going to take the money, but I personally feel like you're not going to turn down and say, no, just give me half of that, I'll be fine, because you've got to take what you can, but then you've got to expect to have what comes with it, which is going to be probably a bit of jealousy. So I guess it's up to you to how. My dad always taught me quite, you know, very well, really, to always go into changing rooms and ask, where can I sit with the senior lads when you're young, you know, give everyone the respect they deserve, and you'll get it back. So I think it's just how you translate what you might get offered into how you portray yourself, which will help you with the senior players. But yeah, it is a tricky one.
Perhaps if it was Tottenham or Arsenal, I don't think the money's anywhere near what Chelsea and Man City give to the young. Is that because you just want to win the battle to sign the best prospects and you realise that you've got to go above and beyond to get the signature?
Yeah, I'd say that's it. I'd say they have the money and they were willing to invest it in the kids. From the outside looking in, you'd think, well, you're in a bubble now, you're in the Chelsea bubble. It's easy to, I think, I'll get comfortable.
And is this the time where it's important with who you've got around you?
Really, really important, because that's the time where people will come knocking on your door. People want to be your best friend, your agent wants to be... For me, I was fortunate I had good agents, but I know other players and you get to learn about their potential agents, and are they just in it for the financial game, or will they get you the move that benefits them? It's a question mark to be had. So you do have to be really wary. But at that age, you're so young, you're inexperienced. Unless you've probably got the right people, like your parents or close friends around you that can guide you, it can quickly turn and go wrong.
How do you get the right mentor at that age? Because going back to what you were saying about the car, if you could do that again, would that be the first thing that you'd think, I want to buy that? Or is it just purely because you're young and you don't have that leadership? Everybody around you's probably got a nice car as well.
Just talking about the car specifically, so in my team, I was one of the younger players in terms of, I signed my pro contract on my at the end of July, but some players that were born earlier than me would actually sign it on their 17th birthday. So they're already driving fancy cars, and to be honest, yeah, you don't want to be the one that's going to go and get, I don't know, a Corsa. No disrespect to Corsas, but if they're driving Audis and BMWs and whatnot, then at that age you don't want to do that. But looking back now, with mature shoulders on me, I would happily do that, you know. But you almost have to experience these things to learn from them, whether that be buying clothes, spending fortunes on designer clothes. I look back now and think, what an idiot, you know. But I was grateful and glad I experienced it. Cars, clothes, nightclubs, all that stuff, because I know what it was like. Whereas if you'd never experienced it, you'd always probably be wondering, oh, I want that, or I wonder what that's like. But as a young player now, if they're in my shoes and they had potentially the money that I was on at that age, then yeah, I wouldn't really care about the car, the clothes. You got to think long term, you know, because football's a short career. You haven't got people around you potentially saying, buy a couple of houses or do this for your money, do that with your money. But I would definitely advise that now.
Did you have any idea, Luke, what to do with your money when you first started getting paid?
I was in the Tottenham first team and I would have been still on about £1,500 a week. So it was completely different. I only saw sort of better money towards the back end of my career. So although that is good money compared to what my friends were on, etc., it wasn't like sort of life-changing money at that stage. And it probably was good for me because I was always searching for the next deal and always trying to push myself, knowing that I've got to improve, I've got to be better to get the next deal, or if you're at a lesser club, you need to excel to get a move to a bigger league and things like that. So you had to at least get in the first team before better money came. Whereas I feel like obviously in Charlie's days, that they were snapping up the best talent in the country, paying them very, very well for lads that you had no idea whether they were going to make it or not. But it was almost like, let's get the best talent, let's get them all on contract, and let's see where this takes us. And I think Chelsea, perhaps at the minute, and the Man Cities of this world, they're buying young players from other academies, and then they're developing them as players. They're getting a great development, they're getting great facilities, great training, they looked after, they get schooling, etc. But then where do they go after that? And then suddenly they're on loan, and then they come back, they go on loan again, they come back. And if the loans go well, they're then worth quite a bit of money. So then they'll potentially get sold. So sometimes I feel like it can be more of a business side of things now, rather than creating and developing players to play in Chelsea's first team. It almost seems a little bit like a business model to make money.
I think it's really important, if you're happy to, when you sign that first professional deal, like we hear about money being thrown around in football. Are you happy to tell us what that figure was?
Do you know what? I actually can't even remember. It was in the thousands though, yeah, for sure.
A week?
Yeah. Without sounding arrogant, it's like, it's easy money as well. You know, you're going into your job every day, you're training in the best facilities, you're playing, and then your money's hitting your bank account at the end of the month, you know, and you come into the real world and people struggle to make money and get money. It's a completely different world, so...
This is where it's vital for me that they've got good people around them. I've actually started a company myself, mentoring and analysis for younger players, and I feel like it's vital. We watch the players' games of a weekend. We cut the clips of the things that they do well and the things that we feel that they could do better. But more importantly, when we feed that back over a Zoom call or video call, there's mentoring involved in that as well. So it's like players that are out the side, players that are injured, how do they deal with that? Monetary, you know, if they sign a big contract, like, okay, listen, keep your feet on the ground, stay grounded, concentrate on the football. And I feel like when it comes from someone who's been on the same path, that's experienced all of these decisions that you're going to be experiencing in the near future, it's kind of lived experience, you know, and the advice given from sort of ex-players to these young lads. When I was at Tottenham, we had one of the best strikers in the country called James Bunn, playing for Tottenham in England. And James got given like maybe a 2 or 3 year professional contract before anyone else in my peer group. So we'd have all been trying to strive for a YTS deal, apprenticeship. And then once you got that, if you played really, really well, you might get a pro. But you might, if you're lucky, you'll find out at Christmas of your second year. some of the boys were going into sort of March, April, not knowing if they're getting a pro. But James knew at 15 that he had a 2 or 3 year deal. So on his 17th birthday, he's got a BMW with Bunny as his number plate, you know, private registration, and he's bowling in, driving in. And I feel like, hopefully he's not listening, but that he took his eye off the ball a little bit and probably felt that he'd arrived. He had a few quid in his pocket, was going out probably a little bit too much. And I don't feel like his dedication was the same. And I'm pretty sure that he would regret even getting that pro that early because it stopped him striving for the next deal.
Your view on football as a sport and as a system, how do they differ, Charlie?
Yeah, so the love of the game would never go. I think I was saying off air with you guys, when you're playing in a game, like a 90-minute game, and you have a good game, me being a winger, I might set up a goal, score a goal, hopefully. You can't beat that feeling of football. But what comes with football, unfortunately, is a lot of politics. You know, it's a ruthless business, really. And there's a lot that goes on behind closed doors that people don't know about from the outside looking in. Because I think from the outside looking in, it's great. Like, you're a footballer, and don't get me wrong, it is. You think you go in every day, you train. What a life. But I fell out of love with that, with the politics of football and what came with it, more than training, playing.
Have you got an example that you can share?
Do you know what it is? I don't really want to out certain individuals or managers, because that's not really who I was. Definitely not who I am as a person. But just whether it be, you might be going through a spell of injuries, which you can't control, but also the way you might get treated by clubs, by managers.
What would be on that list for you, Luke?
Well, I worked in the agency world for a short period of time. I've seen kind of firsthand that if a club have paid money for a player, say they've paid, I don't know, 200, 300 grand for a young lad from a lesser academy, if he comes into your building and you are the same position as him and you're perhaps outplaying him and you're training better than him and he's struggling and it's quite clear for everyone to see that he might be struggling and you're the better option for the Saturday starting 11, but you find yourself not playing, that can be some of these types of politics that can go on. So one, the club have paid money for this player. Two, one of the coaches might know, be friends with the agent that got him to the club. Without elaborating too much, wherever there is astronomical sums of money, you'll find slight bits of corruption that can go on. Sometimes there's vested interest in certain players that the whole group probably won't know about. Charlie, can I just ask you, did you feel that there was this sort of a race for the signatures of the best players and that it wasn't always for the benefit of the player to develop them? It was more of how can we get the most amount of talent signed up so then we can make money off these lads going forward?
I think a lot of that's what agencies are, to be honest. It's another ruthless business. But I remember when I was 16, I just played for England under 16s. So I sort of just established myself. It was on the Victory Shield, which was at the time, it was like live on Sky. It's a big game. They don't actually do it anymore. And after that, my dad met, I think it was around 9 agents, where he'd meet them for coffees and they'd sort of almost pitch to him, well, we should be the agents to look after your son. And I just know a lot of those agents would have had that mindset of, well, he's just played on Sky, playing for England, playing for Chelsea. We can get him. Then we can monetize massively from this, you know. So I'd look at agency the same way I look at football. There's not many good guys in football. So when you get them, keep them around you because it's so important. And I'd say the same with the agents. There's a lot of agents out there that they do just want what's best for them. But there's also the agents that really just care for you and they're just good people. And if they could have a comment on being an agent, it would be, oh, this agency probably wasn't what I thought it was. There's a lot of people in this game out, you know, backstabbing and all this. Your career can go from having a real good potential to your next move, to your agent being in control of that, to it all going south because they've picked it, a club, or picked the best deal. Because it's always, I'm sure you're the same, you always want to be a fly on the wall, don't you, when your agent's having these conversations with clubs. Because it's easy for an agent to ring you and go, right, so this has been said, that club are interested, that club might be interested. But I learned that the word interested meant f*** all, because everyone could be interested in you. But until there was a contract on the table from a club, you just could never know. So you always wanted to be a fly on the wall and go, what did they say that? Was that actually said? And unfortunately, a lot of agents can give you what you want to hear. One, to make them look like they're doing a great job. And two, financially, they can gain a lot.
How on earth did your dad know how to deal with that amount of agents talking to him? That's not a world he's been in either.
No, it was so new to him as well. And my dad's a very honest person, and he just got a vibe of who he felt for me would be the right people, you know. So again, I was lucky to have him, being able to meet them, because I didn't even meet a lot of them. It was him himself. So it was good because he knew he'd been around, he played as well, and he knew what people might be potentially trying to get from myself. So he could come away from a conversation a good judge of character and know. But you don't always have them people. So
there's a lot of good agents out there, but I feel like they're now having to maybe resort to some of the tactics that the lesser agents are doing, because you try and be honest in that world and you try and be fair and not raise expectation too much, but that's not selling a good enough story or a good enough dream. So it's got to the stage now where some of these young academy players' families, they know that there's monetary value in signing for a certain agent. So before they have these 9 meetings, like Charlie's family went through, they're almost saying, well, what's the deal for us? Because there's ways of the parents being induced and paid by the agencies to come on board to be looked after by certain agencies. So they're now wise to it now. These are the academy parents. Back then they wasn't. It was new. Lots of them, I don't blame them, lots of them who are not well-off parents that could do with, you know, a cash injection, are taking the money up front because the odds that their son is going to go on and become a player and the money might not be there. So they take it straight away and they sign with certain agents, but sometimes for the wrong reasons. With this youth market, if you've got a young lad and you move him from one club to another, there's millions or, you know, 500 grand for the agent in these types of deals. That's why you see such an arms race to sign the best youngsters. If you've got the best youngster and he's ripping it up at, say, Millwall or Charlton, and you know one of the Cat 1 clubs wants him, there's a transfer fee involved in that. The agent will receive some of that and the parents will receive some of that. So that's kind of the way it goes now. And that's why Charlie alluded to it. Wherever there's big money in any industry, there'll be ways of people exploiting that.
When you've got a parent-child relationship and all the stuff you've just said there, that's the lines are blurred between, you know, looking after your child and seeing the pound signs.
There's nothing new that I've said there to you. You know that, don't you? Most
yeah,
of
I
that,
do.
Yeah.
100%. 100%.
When did injuries start to become an issue for you, Charlie?
When I was 18. So up to 18, you have growth spurts, you have injuries, you have, you know, your odd one here and there. Especially when I was on trial, back when I was 12, I had loads of injuries. I was on trial for 9 months and a lot of that was due to growth spurts, different injuries and et cetera. But from the moment I signed at Chelsea, I sort of managed to have a good run of staying injury free. But yeah, got to 18 and had my first hamstring injury, which was a reoccurring injury, unfortunately, which lasted around 18 months to 2 years of just constantly, I'd get fit, play, pull my hamstring, get fit, play, do my rehab. You know, it was an ongoing cycle of that. So yeah, that's probably 18 was when it first began, yeah.
I mean, how close were you to making your first team debut for Chelsea?
The director of football at Chelsea was called Michael Emanado. I don't know if you guys have heard of him.
Yeah.
He went to Monaco after Chelsea, but I remember sort of when I was having a run of games, he was in the academy building and Victor Moses was playing in that wing-back role under Conte, and he was flying, to be fair. Like, they won the Premier League that year and I was obviously a similar position to Victor Moses, and he said, you're coming on the pre-season tour next year at the end of the season. Said to my parents, I'm going on the first team tour with Chelsea. And well, they didn't believe me, but it's almost like, oh, talk can be cheap. Like, that'd be great if you do, but whatever. I remember thinking like, ah, that's, I'm going to actually be going on the first team tour. And then obviously pulled my hamstring again during that time. But I managed to sign a second pro contract during this time. So Chelsea obviously were, they still believed in my ability and they wanted to keep me on. So I remember that day I signed, I went to sign it in the first team building with my parents. And as we were going upstairs, Marco Minardo was in the first team building this time coming down. And he sort of said to me, oh, like, what happened? You was meant to come on the tour. And obviously my parents heard that because they were with me. So obviously they sort of now, not that I was but they was like, oh, so he did want you to come on the first pre-season tour. For example, Conte might have liked me in that role, and then you can grow from there. But I never obviously played a first team game.
Can you ever ask, like when you mentioned Conte there, can you ask the question, how close am I?
I remember just a story. So when Jose Mourinho was the manager's second stint, I trained with the first team, and he just called me the kid. So I think if you're just known as the kid, then they need to know your name, I think, before you can even get a chance. But I guess that was just his personality.
You were training with first team players. You've just mentioned Antonio Conte, Jose Mourinho, some of the greatest managers.
Yeah.
You must look back on this fondly.
100%. Really grateful for those experiences in my life, to be honest, because not a lot of people my age at the time were doing that. So, yeah, never take that for granted. And, you know, I'll always look back proud with them memories of holding the thoughts of, oh, yeah, I trained with some world-class players. So, yeah, and I was very grateful.
Who marked you? Who did you train with?
I was there 8 years, and I probably trained with the first team for the first time when I was 16, 17 maybe. So from that, there was loads of managers. Forget players. You know what Chelsea was like. One manager came in, out the door, the next one. Aspilicueta, he was one of the ones that had such a great career at Chelsea, didn't he?
Like Dave.
That's it. And he came in, and I don't think anyone quite knew who they'd signed with him. I remember he played a 23s game when he first signed, Aspilicueta. And it was like almost, who's this sort of thing? And then he's gone on to be one of the best players for Chelsea, in my opinion.
Are you looking ahead of yourself thinking, where do I go here? Like, there's no way, it's like a bottleneck. Like, it's full of top players in my own age category, top players just above me, and then top world-class internationals in the first team. Are you thinking, this looks like a loan, and then another loan, and another loan? Like, do the players talk about that within your own age category?
Yeah, I think at the time, there was no one coming through. Like, John Terry was the last person to really establish himself in the Chelsea first team. So that was sort of saying something. We always had to have that belief that it could be you. You had to have that belief. And I think if you didn't have that belief, you wouldn't be playing for Chelsea's academy and the under 23. So you always had that belief. But yeah, the reality was everyone was going on loan. Whether you was like the best player really in the academy, you were still going on loan somewhere to get first team experience. So people always spoke. I mean, there's a loan group at Chelsea anyway, where they have their own changing room, their own coaching, their own staff, I think their own WhatsApp group chat. So that's when you know that the likelihood is you probably will go on loan, because they've got 40 players ready to go on loan.
So in your opinion, yep, you can sit on the fence on this one if you want, but is the strategy of Chelsea's academy to get the player, the top talent, develop it and sell it for a profit, or is it to get the top players, feed them through to the first team to become a first team player for Chelsea, or both?
On paper, when I was there, it was definitely to sell on, because the statistics didn't lie. Everyone was really doing that, but I think it has changed now. I think it's definitely got better. I think after Frank Lampard came in and he gave players that I played with an opportunity in the first team, he was the first to do it. And since then, more players have come through more than ever. But it's still, majority of it would be to sell on and make money, because they've got the money to sign anyone they want anyway. So, like I was going back to, it's a ruthless business, and Chelsea are very, very good at it, where they can just afford to buy anyone and sell them on. So I would say, yeah, probably not the latter. I'd say it's probably that they want to sell players on.
Luke, in the first step we did, you talked about there being two dressing rooms at QPR towards the end because there were so many players, and you, Charlie, just mentioned this lone dressing room. Is there a kind of delayed response in actually dealing with that mentally? Because that seems like a very unhealthy work environment.
Yeah, I think you get a lot of that. I think in that loan group a lot went on because the players aren't happy. So the coaches are dealing with players that don't really want to be there, don't want to train, constantly probably ringing their agents, telling them to get me out of here or whatever conversations are going on. So it's a real toxic place, to be honest. I was back at Chelsea recently. You know, I went to see some old staff members, which was nice. And there was still a loan group there then. It was sort of the up-and-coming season was approaching and they had a loan group. I was speaking to the physio. He said, oh, I've got to go and take the loan group now, cover that session, which was a variety of like 23s players that had played, established themselves regularly in the first team, which have now been dropped out and were playing at training in this group. And you could just get the vibe that it's not the happiest of places. But I get it, because you're watching your old teammates go and train the first team and getting ready for a season, and you're thinking, where am I going? I'm not valued anymore. So
how many hamstring injuries did you have?
I probably ended up having around 10 now. But look back on the course of from the first one to now, yeah, 10.
So a specialist wanted you to have surgery. Chelsea's experts wanted you to have stem cell treatment. This is your body. You're very young. How hard is it to know who has your best interests in mind?
I think because they're physios, doctors at Chelsea, you just instantly think they're the best in the world, you know, best at what they do. So you trust and value what they're telling you to do, I think. You're so young, you don't really know what's right and what's wrong.
Can you tell us what that entails then? The stem cell treatment sounded very peculiar when you talked about it.
It does, doesn't it? All I can say is I highly recommend it to anyone that might be needing it, because it worked wonders for my hamstring in terms of the area that I was constantly having reoccurring injuries, which is like in the tendon, which is high up in my hamstring. That was where I was having real difficulty in staying injury-free. That was never happened again since having the stem cell procedure. But at the time, it was very new, very fresh. No one really knew about it. There wasn't many studies on it. It was more just, oh, we've heard it's good. We're willing to spend money on it for me. And they would rather that than surgery. So I was like, cool. And they flew me out to Barcelona, where it was mainly done at that time. That was the most well-known place for it to be done. And I had it done out there.
It's an injection, though.
It's an injection, but what happens is, so I went out to Barcelona a month before and had bone marrow taken out of my hips, and then that gets sent to a laboratory in Italy where it grows for a month in some laboratory, and then I get flown back out to Barcelona to the same place, but this time then I have the stem cell procedure, which is like an injection. It was crazy because it took them about 45 minutes just to make sure the area was like cleaned. Like, so much goes into it, so much detail. The actual procedure itself might only be 10 minutes, to be honest, but the overall thing could be an hour or two.
So at this stage, how many hamstring injuries have you had for it to get to the stage where we're talking about surgery and stem cell? Are we well into three or four hamstring injuries?
We're about six at this point. So what would happen is I'd pull my hamstring. I would then do the rehab with the physio at Chelsea, which would be involved a lot of gym work, a lot of strength work, do all the tests, and they would all look really strong. Be like, oh, I've got the strongest hamstrings in the team now because I've been doing them every day. You're ready to train. And then I'd go and be like, okay, I'm fit. I'd go and train, get through the session. Okay, now you can play 20 minutes at the weekend. Would come on for 20 minutes at the end of the game, do a couple of sprints and bang, it's gone again. Hamstring's gone. Okay, now we'll start again then. We'll do the rehab in the gym. We'll do the same things. We'll get your hamstring strong. We'll get you in the gym. We'll get you training. We'll get you playing. So that happened repetitively five times, sorry. That's when I was like, surely we need to do something different here. And that's where it became a really unique injury, where the physios at the time, and this is no disrespect to them because I've still got a great relationship with the one now, it was just something new to everyone. No one really knew what was going on with my injury. Just not seen it before. They'd seen plenty of hamstring injuries, but they hadn't seen one that's constantly going. So then that's when we brought in the hierarchy of the football club, the main first team doctors, physios, to assess the situation. Everyone recommended I go and see a surgeon in London. Went to see this surgeon. No word of a lie, I was in there for 2 minutes. So we went there, me and the physio sat down. He was like, look, you've sent me all the scans. We don't really need to say anything here. Apart from you definitely need surgery. I've seen all your MRI scans. I can't really believe you haven't had it yet. And at this point, I'd been out for a long time anyway, but I was like, I just want my hamstring to be able to last a game. And then that's when they came back. They pulled me and my parents into the physio room and just said, this is what we want to do. And that's when I first heard the word stem cell and went from there.
Through all of this, I hope this question makes sense. How much did you miss football?
A lot. You go into the same environment every day. You're just not going onto the training pitch. So you're constantly around your teammates. You're still in the changing room in the mornings. You're still around everything that comes with it. But you're missing the most important part, which is actually training with your friends, really, as well as your teammates, and then playing on the weekend. So it was tough because you sort of go out the changing room door, you go right, and your teammates go left. So a lot of the time it was just, I used to say it was like me and my shadow. Like it was just me putting in the graft. No one really appreciated it because why would you? I'm injured. I'm just trying to get back fit. The manager doesn't care about you, but he's got a team to worry about. So you're just going and going, all the work I'm doing is for me, not for anyone else. No one sees it. No one really cares. But I know, okay, I've got to graft it. I've got to just get on with it. Otherwise, I'm not going to get fit. And your teammates are going left and all training together. So that was probably the hardest part. Not because it's out of your control. I didn't ask to get injured. But that's where I was fortunate because my mindset was always everything happens for a reason. I don't quite know why, because my surroundings weren't really that. People around me weren't that. But I was almost like, no, like this is happening for a reason. It might take, well, it's taken 10 years to be honest. I sort of relate it to my business now. It might take 10 years, it might take 1 year, it might take 5, but you'll see why everything's happening. So I was lucky because I always said that to myself for every injury I had, and that's how I managed to stay as positive as I did. But yeah, that was probably the hardest part, watching your teammates train, watching your teammates play, knowing you couldn't, knowing your contract was running out as well, thinking, well, I've not been able to prove myself. So I'm probably not going to get a deal. And to be honest, if they told me I wasn't, I wouldn't really be able to say that's unfair because they're thinking, well, you've not played, you know, and it's a business.
There's nothing worse than being injured and for Charlie to go through that constant cycle of getting fit, right, I'm ready to play a game, breaking down, and then having to start again, and then to get the news that it's going to be another 9 months, like, complete credit to you to carry on and show the resilience to keep going.
I appreciate it.
I know a lot of people that probably would have stopped a lot earlier because you're a little bit embarrassed to see the managers and everyone's asking, how are you every day? And you're like, well, I've got 9 months of this, so yeah, I'm all right. But don't ask me every day for 9 months, please, you know, because I'm frustrated enough that I'm not out there and playing. The players that Charlie would have been ahead of, they'll be improving year after year after year. Whereas it's so stop-start for Charlie. He's not getting on a run. He's not getting any momentum. He's not improving, working out what works in games, what doesn't.
It is an incredibly emotionally mature response for someone who's in their, what, early 20s as well. And I just wonder, you two come from very different eras of football. Was there ever an issue you struggled with, Luke, where you just didn't say anything? Because it sounds like you would have shared more than potentially Luke would have. Do you remember a moment like that?
No one shared anything in my day, if I'm honest with you. You always had this bravado. You, even deep down, if you're thinking, I'm not playing well, it's my fault for the goal the weekend, you've got to put it to the side. And it's literally, every time you put your boots on, it's a new session and you've got to attack that session. Then you can go home and start thinking about things that are not going so well for you. But you can't really talk about stuff and you can't really say anything to the management because they'll see that as a sign of weakness and that, you know, he's not mentally able to have a career in the game and to play Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday for me and my side for what I need. So
has that
you just
changed?
Don't show it.
Has that changed now?
Yeah. Massively changed now. Well, it's just mental health in general has become a really hot topic, which is great, you know, because like you were saying, back in your day, people were so much worse off. Because you just couldn't say nothing, you know. Mm. And that's partly why I done the documentary we were speaking about before. Obviously, I come on here was because I experienced what I experienced. I knew that players had probably experienced worse than me, but wouldn't have been able to speak up. So it was almost just hoping that a platform would be able to be created for people to speak up. And I actually remember doing that documentary. I mean, I was looking to get a club. That documentary came out a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, I think now. And then fast forward last year or the year before, I was trying to get a club and I had this agent working for me. And one of the things he said was, oh, this manager, he said he's in that documentary about mental health, almost if to say like, oh, I'm not sure on him sort of thing. And I'm thinking to myself, like, luckily for me, I've never really ever struggled with mental health. But I really want to see that documentary to put it out there for people that have, because I know there's plenty of footballers that do. But that's sort of how it's being perceived by certain people and their managers. So like you said, why would you want to go and say to your manager, I'm struggling today? Because he's probably going to think, well, I need 3 points, so I don't really want to play you, you know, which is completely wrong, but that's just how it is. So it is changing, but people like that manager, for example, I'm not going to out that manager, but they need to see it differently. You know, they do.
I think that's why it's vitally important that you've got someone to talk to away from your club. So if you've got someone that you can trust in, like I say, what I do now, my company's called Elevate, and what we do is we try to be a sounding board for the players. So obviously I've been through the same journey that these players are going on. And if they don't feel comfortable to talk to anyone within the club, which I understand, because I would never have wanted to show, you know, just a little crack of sort of weakness, because you will get left out by certain managers. So you've got someone away from the club and away from family that you can talk to in an honest way and you trust their opinion. That's someone that you can get things off your chest to. And I think that's vitally important now, especially with these young players and the pressures that are, especially with social media and stuff like that now. I think the pressures have gone up, the money's gone up, but there's less people to talk to. So I think it's important that they have people away from the club that they can use as a sounding board.
We should shout out that documentary. It's very important. It's on YouTube, right? It's called Man Up. One of the things you talk about in there is the passing of your uncle Lee, who died by suicide. How did his death affect you?
Yeah, it was a shock, really. I think I've not got a big family. There's not many of us. So it was my dad's brother, his only brother. So when it's, I'm not saying when you've got a massive family and you've got all these cousins and second cousins, it's easier, but we were tight knit. So my mum's got one sister, she didn't, and her sister hasn't had any kids. And obviously my dad's brother only had one. So I've only got one real cousin. So yeah, real small family. So it did affect everyone quite a lot. I mean, it was actually just before COVID as well, which is probably worse, because then you're getting locked in your houses and can't really like take your mind off it. Nothing's going on in the world. So all you can probably think about is Lee. It's difficult. My dad's obviously would be the man of the house. You know, he's the dad, but I almost had to be there for him more than anything, reverse roles, and be there for all my family. But I think because of what I experienced with football, having to like go through all the setbacks and all of that and in general life with that, it probably helped me be able to be the sounding board for my family and be able to go, it's devastating what's happened, but I can actually be there for them more than they could be there for me. You know, not that I didn't grieve any less than them, but I was prepared to take that on myself and go, okay, let me help them. Obviously, we'll never wish that on any family, anyone, but it sort of came after my injuries and I was like, that's why I need to do this documentary, Man Up. Wouldn't have done it otherwise. And to be honest, it was great because so many managers, players, people were reaching out to me with messages personally that I could speak to them for and probably be a sounding board for them as well, which you probably wouldn't have thought they would have done it, because that's normally how it is. You don't see, you think the people that are probably the most comfortable, the ones that are just constantly happy in their environments, they'll be fine. And then they're the ones that reached out to me to say, oh, I appreciate that, I needed that. So yeah, it was good.
Jeremy Whiston is one of those horrifically sad stories of teenagers taking their own life, having been released by a club. Have you spoken to clubs or academies about what more they could be doing if you are released?
There was always conversations with what more could they do? Because at the time, it felt like to me, I don't know about you guys, but it was like a tick box exercise where they might have someone come in for an hour once every year or 6 months, give the presentation. Someone might think about it for a day. As a player, for example, might reach out now that they've come in, and then it's gone. And it's like, right, we tick that off, we'll go again and we'll probably bring that up in a year's time and then come back in. And it was almost like, that's enough. Like, we don't really need to do any more. So it's like the tick box exercise is nowhere near enough and it needed to change and they need to have a lot more support around the players. But I think, just want to say as well, credit to you, by the way, because what you're doing sounds incredible, because players probably don't want to speak to members of staff at the club. they don't want to speak to their parents, and they don't want to speak to their friends. Whereas if they got someone like you, who they can respect because you've played in the Premier League, you've had a career, they know they can open up to you if that's what you're offering, like you're actually doing it for that reason. Whereas if you go and see someone, a paid person that does this as a profession, you know really like how you have to question it, how much do they really care, or how much are they, they're just going to tell me probably what I want to hear. I think that probably mental health's been put down the ladder a lot at clubs in terms of like a job that they can offer to a member of staff. Like it probably gets belittled compared to your physios, your S&C coaches, all those people. They need to be at a similar level to all the staff where they can have someone come in. But then like what I was just saying is like, do they really want to speak to someone at the club? Because they might know, they might think, he might go and tell the manager, or word might get round at the football club. So I think it's much better having it separately from the club.
What should families of academy players be on the lookout for? Charlie, start with you.
Oh, this could be a long one.
Yeah. I think if you're comparing yourself to a player that played in the academy like myself, who's in a Cat 1 academy, you've got the best coaching, best facilities. What comes with that is like the best money, the best lifestyle as a teenager that you can get. What comes with that probably gives you more pressure, potentially more negative thoughts. So if you're in that higher hierarchy of like, okay, I'm a 17, 18 year old academy player, I'm on thousands a week, cars, clubs, you name it, you can have it. And for whatever reason, it doesn't go well for you for a month or whatever, then you're in a dangerous position, I'd say, with your mental health, even though it might look like you've got everything. So as a family, you're looking at them going, well, my son's, or as friends as well, he must be, have the best lifestyle, he must have the best mentality, he must have the best thoughts that come into his head. They're probably the ones that be most dangerous to think about, because they have everything, but that doesn't mean you have anything.
Let's move forward a little bit. So you've done Baller League now, you've got your 1% supplement business as well. Is football for you done, as it were?
Yeah, I was just saying, like, I'm the happiest I've ever been, which is great. And that's all you really want in life, right? To just be happy, enjoy it. I'm going into a new chapter now with my business. And when I was going back to the injuries there, and I was saying everything happens for a reason, I think that's the reason why it all happened. I'm ready to pursue a new career with 1% supplements. So yeah, I'd say football's done. Football's done, but in a great way, I think. You know, I was saying to you guys, it's like people probably still say to you, oh, when are you going to play again? Or what have you done? Or you've quit. But I'd like to say I've never actually quit anything in life. Like, I like to have that mentality of like, I'm not quit. It's just I see the bigger picture of where I'm heading and what I'm doing. Is it worth it for me? Do I love it? Am I passionate about football as what I was when I was a teenager? I'm not. So it's like, why would I cheat myself in trying to pursue a career that I don't actually enjoy? You know, like the whole surrounds of, not being negative, but the politics of it, all that comes with it. I don't need it in my life. Like, I'm ready for the bigger picture, which is like hopefully longevity with a business that I can put just as much effort as I've put into my career, but it's all on me, which is what I want. I want that pressure to be able to deliver and have things on my terms. I make the decisions, and whatever the outcome is, I can go, I give it my best. So yeah, I'm definitely looking at life always positively, and always I'm ready for what's next. But yeah, Baller League, we done that season one, which was which was actually really good. I enjoyed it.
I heard you talking about Baller League, and you said, I don't know if you remember this, you said 11 versus 11 is toxic. I wonder what you meant by that.
I think we agreed that we were almost like individuals in a team sport, or you could have seen yourself as an individual playing an individual sport, and I'm the same. I just like the whole mentality of like, you know, you know that you've got to do the work, and I'm willing to do the work, and I'm willing to just give it everything. And then that falls on you. Like with my running now, for example, we spoke about it, I know, before we started. It's on me, and I love the fact that I'm training probably harder than I did when I was playing. with my running, but it's all on my own. It's on me. I'm signing up for these races, whether it be 5Ks or marathons or whatever, and I'm trying to beat my times. But no one's picking me to do that. I get to pick, and do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I'm putting in the work, and I reap the rewards. Instead of the football side is a bit of a gamble. You could do everything, but you're the opinion of one person can dictate your whole career. And like for me, like, it's quite a scary thought if you hear that, you know. And I wanted to be in control.
Luke is very jealous of your running times, aren't you?
Really disappointed when I read it, to be honest. But no, credit to you, mate. Doing a sub-3 marathon on your first attempt was quite a special time, mate.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, I just saw that goal in my head, and I was like, you know what? I just want to do it. Like, I think I can do it, because again, it all comes down to the training. I was surrounding myself with people that I was fortunate enough to be around that had experienced running, because you think running is just running, right? But then you get around people that have been in it a while, and there's like all these little techniques and the advice you get given and this, that, and the other, the shoes you should wear and all that. You sort of fall into a deep hole of it. And I said, you know what? Why can't? Because to get a sub-3 is really, really tough on the first one, people would say to you. But I was like, it's a challenge. I want to see where I can take the running. And fortunately enough, we went out to Milan. Me and my girlfriend had done it out there. And I scraped it, to be honest. I think I got 2 hours 59. So I had a minute to spare. Probably not even a minute, 30 seconds.
I love that. And I think it seems like you'll always need that physical competitive challenge as well. All the things I've read and listened about you before this show, like, I think a lot of people ask you, what's next? And there seems to be this expectation that you should want to play football again. I want to ask you, what's not next? Like, what have you learned from this journey of yours that says, okay, I'm not doing that again?
For me, like, my journey that I've been on with football, it was really, looking back now, so many setbacks, you know. And the thing is, people have still had it worse off than me, a lot worse off than me. But the journey I've personally been on myself, I know, has been really tough. And to be honest, I'm proud of coming out on the other side of it. But would I do it again? Yeah, because I've learned so much from my own journey. That's only stead and helped me be what I like to think I am now as a person, you know, with the resilience, the mentality, and how the outlook on life. Without the journey, I might not have had this outlook on life, because I wouldn't have gone through what I went through to be able to speak openly and have the mindset to keep pushing forward now and doing what I'm doing.
Had a little look at your socials, and your terminology that you used was kind of putting football in the past, almost like I've moved forward now and I'm onto a new stage in my life. And the energy that I can feel coming off you when you're talking about your company, it just shows that I can tell that you're excited by it, and you're ready for the next challenge ahead, which is in the business world, and obviously with 1%.
Get Luke some for his running.
Yeah, I've heard he needs it.
I'll be putting pressure on your times, mate.
The question we always ask guests to finish is, when you hear your name, Charlie Wakefield, what comes to mind?
Probably injuries for a lot of people from the outside looking in. But nah, for me personally, I just think resilience to just keep going, whether that just be in life or the experiences I've had in football and business or whatever. Probably just the mentality I'd like to think is that I can just keep pursuing it. I think the hardest thing for people in life is like they have a little bit of an issue with something and it's like the world's ended. If you sort of remove yourself from the situation you're in and have, on the outside looking in, and have a perspective of what has actually happened, okay, how can we fix the situation that's happened, or how can I make this situation better? It's happened for a reason, let's go. Whereas a lot of people, unfortunately, might have the outlook of, oh, I'm going into more, which only brings on more negative thoughts. I think it's just so important to just try and look at life as positively as you can. And yeah, I'll probably end it on that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's a great mindset to have, and we've learned a lot. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it coming on.
And thanks to everyone for watching and listening. We'll be back next week. You can follow the show on socials at More Than A Name Pod. You can get in touch with me and Luke. Email us morethananamepod@gmail.com. Make sure you subscribe to the YouTube channel as well, and we'll see you next time.